Good morning, everyone. Greet you in the name of Jesus. It's good to be with you all again after being gone for a couple of Sundays away from you all. Thankful to be back with you. Turning your Bibles to the book of Matthew once again. Really has been an undertaking to go through a book the length of Matthew. I hope that y'all are getting things out of it as much as I have been. However, I will admit to you that when I started this, I guess I knew that I would eventually get Matthew chapter 24, but I guess I also hoped that I would be prepared to preach it when I got here. And the bad news is, I don't know that I'm ready to actually talk about Matthew 24 very much. Now you're wondering what in the world is in Matthew 24, right? Well, let's read the chapter. Matthew chapter 24, verse 1. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall rise, and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. Excuse me. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say unto you, Lo, here's Christ, or there, believe it not, for there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, Behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, he is in the secret chambers, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh out of the east, and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Then shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched, and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household, to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant, whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But, and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, My Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites, then there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. We have a chapter that has puzzled people. I don't know if it puzzled people since the day Jesus gave it or not. This passage, though, let me back up. There are many times you can take a passage of Scripture and you can read it and you know that it means what it says, that to try to interpret it or to try to make it say something other than what it says, you would end up really wresting the Scriptures. However, I would submit to you that that is not so much the case with this passage, because by its very nature, when Jesus spoke it, it was all future. And so it needed to be interpreted by the disciples, and possibly needs to be interpreted by us. It's a little like you can read things, but you don't always understand them. If you go to verse 15, Jesus even talks about that. When you see, therefore, the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, whoso readeth, let him understand. So it's possible to read and not understand. I thought about trying to illustrate that, but I'm not sure that I need to. You understand what I mean. Unless you have a understanding of the command or the statement, you can read certain things and it wouldn't make any sense. I'm going to use a method of presenting this passage to you this morning that would probably send some of my ancestors into fits, and maybe shouldn't even be done. But there's a debate over this passage about whether these things are past or whether they are future. And so I'm going to give you kind of an overview of both schools of thought. It's probably not the best idea in the world, because it feels a little bit like a dodge and not actually telling you what I think about it. But I actually will, as we go along, give you some thoughts of where I come in on this whole thing. Now, to say that there's two views of this passage is very simplistic, because this passage is also in Mark and it's also in Luke. And if we were studying just this passage, I would take you there and we would try to dissect everything. But there's different little things that you'll see in Mark and in Luke that aren't necessarily here. There's also this reference to Daniel the prophet. And so when you go back into Daniel chapter 9, chapter 11, and chapter 12, you will see this statement of the abomination of desolation that Jesus refers to. And there's huge debates about what that is. And I'm not really interested in that. I want to just talk about what Matthew has to say here and what it possibly means. As I already said, if we were to just take a reading of this text and ask ourselves the question, is this future or is it past? The answer is that the text is future because it hadn't happened yet. When Jesus spoke this, nothing had happened that he's talking about. You okay with that? The question for us sitting here in 2018 is, has it happened yet or not? But for Jesus, it was all future. And so the language can kind of confuse us sometimes because it really was all future. And if we're not careful, we can say that it still is future. Or perhaps if we're accurate, we would say that it's still future. Well, some people in 2018, excuse me, not sure what's the matter with my voice this morning. Some people actually believe that the entire chapter is past, that it all took place around the year of 70 AD, which would have been the destruction of Jerusalem by the Roman general Titus. They believe that even all the way through verse 51, if I understand their view right, all the way through verse 51 is past, that Jesus really did come back. Verse 37 talks about the coming of the Son of Man. Verse 30 talks about the sign of the Son of Man coming in the clouds. And they believe that that all happened only in a spiritual sense at the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, that view is far enough out that I'm not really going to discuss it, because I think we would have to be a little bit naive to say that Jesus has come back in some spiritual way. There's too much explicit language about the return of Jesus for us to just say that it all happened. Okay, let's not even talk about that view. The next view that people have is that part of it is historic and part of it is yet future. For instance, if you read the question that the disciples asked, they said, when shall these things be? What are these things? Well, we would go back and look at what Jesus just said. Jesus said that there will not be a stone left upon another. And the interpretation of this view of part of it being past and part of it yet future would say that these things happened at the fall of the destruction of Jerusalem. And indeed, when Jerusalem was destroyed, there was no stones left on another. It was decimated. Horrible stories that you can read about that. But then whenever you get to the latter part of the chapter, Jesus is answering the question, what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? So you see the split there in the two, part of its past, part of its future. There's a third school of thought that would say that all of this is future, that everything you read here has not happened, and that these are signs that will occur, these are things that will happen at the very end of the present age. There's a little bit of validity to that view if you want to be honest with it. So let's just go over the chapter here. And first of all, we're going to look at this divided view. Part of its past, part of its future. Let's look at what Jesus said is going to happen. First of all, he says in verse 5 that there's going to be people coming in my name saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. Well, has that happened? Did it happen prior to the fall of Jerusalem? Well, the person that you almost have to get any type of sense of the history there is the man by the name of Josephus, the man that wrote a whole bunch of stuff about the history of the Jews, and he did a really good job. He mentions two people in particular, an Egyptian And if you want to reference this, if you want to go home and read this in Josephus, you can look it up in the book called The Wars of the Jews, Part 2, 13:5. It's divided in sections like that. But anyway, this Egyptian had a following of about 30,000 men, and he was going to try to get Jerusalem away from the Romans. And by the way, this is all before the final destruction by Titus. So just hold on to that thought. We're trying to answer the question, is all of these things past? Have they happened surrounding the destruction of Jerusalem? Another little interesting thing about this Egyptian, if you will, turn to Acts. I have no idea what the connection here is, if there is a connection. It's just something I came across that I found very fascinating. In Acts chapter 20, no, that's not right. That's what I have written, but that can't be right. Maybe one of you Bible scholars can help me out. In Acts somewhere, Paul is questioned as to being this Egyptian that had men in the wilderness. Where is that? I have 20 written down, but that is not right. Is it Acts 21? Thank you. It's Acts 21. Yes. This is Paul in Acts 21, verse 37. And as Paul was led into the castle, he said unto the chief captain, "May I speak unto thee?" Who said, "Canst thou speak Greek?" Art not thou that Egyptian which before these days madest in an uproar and leddest out into the wilderness 4,000 men that were murderers? Now there it just says 4,000. And Josephus says 30,000. I'm not really trying to establish that these are the two people, but it is fascinating that this shows up. There was such a man as an Egyptian taking people into the wilderness trying to do something. And they were afraid of that Egyptian. They said that he had an uproar, that he created some uproar. And anyway, that man, of course, was... He didn't get much accomplished. He ended up leaving his men and fleeing when things got a little rough for him. But anyway, also in the Antiquities of the Jews, Josephus mentions another man over the same sort of the same time as a false prophet going around trying to get a following. This is possibly what Jesus was referring to surrounding the events just before the fall of Jerusalem. What about the wars and rumors of wars? Well, the thought here is that in this past view that this has already been fulfilled, that of course during that time there was a lot of upheaval politically. The question that I run into on this particular thing of wars and rumors of wars and nations rising against nations and all of that, it seems to me that that has been the story of human history. And you could point to any point in history and say, yeah, there's wars and rumors of wars. So I'm not sure that I would get too adamant about that. But in the history of the world, certain times it seems like there was a lot of wars. And so it could easily be fulfilled, very easily. What about this famines thing? Verse 7. There's going to be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places. I found it interesting to notice that in Acts 11, we have Agabus predicting a worldwide famine. And there was churches that were trying to plan for this and send relief to different people. So this all, of course, would have taken place before the destruction of Jerusalem. Very likely could be fulfilled in that sense. I also found it interesting that a book written by Marcellus Kick, I guess that's how you say his name, he wrote a book called An Eschatology of Victory, and he mentions that in AD 62, and also in the time period around there, there were earthquakes recorded in the cities of the areas of Crete, Smyrna, Miletus, Chios, I think I'm saying that right, Samos, Laodicea, Hierapolis, Colossae, Campania, Rome, and Judea. So there was definitely earthquakes happening. Pompeii was damaged by an earthquake in 62. Now, if you're a student of history, you'll recognize this city named Pompeii. What happened later in AD 79 was that it was covered up by Mount Vesuvius. But several years before that, it had been damaged severely by a 7.5 magnitude earthquake. So again, we're looking here at possibilities of these passages being fulfilled coming up to the time of the destruction of Jerusalem. We're trying to see if these things fit. Well, moving on, Jesus warns them about persecution, being afflicted, being betrayed. Well, that has been all through the history of Christianity. If you get to verse 14, you get some very plain language that if you were to just pull this verse out and read it, it would be astounding. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. So we could conclude from that verse alone that Jesus, the end of the world, his return, all of those cataclysmic events will not happen until every person in the world has had the gospel preached to them. There's people that actually believe that. And you really can't blame them for reading that verse and concluding that. I'll just read you a verse in Colossians chapter 1, verse 23. He's writing to the Colossians. He says, "If ye continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel which ye have heard, and which was preached to every creature which is under heaven." That's Paul writing in the book of Colossians. So has the whole world heard the gospel? Is it meant to be taken explicitly as it is written, or is it not? When we get to verse 15 and we see this phrase, the abomination of desolation, I suppose that to give all the different ideas of what this is meaning would really take two or three sermon sessions. So I'm going to just really brush over this really, really, really quick. This phrase is certainly referring to Daniel, because Jesus said so. There's no question about that. The question is, what does it mean? Well, if you're looking for fulfilled prophecies, you would say that this happened several times. There was, what was his name? That Greek guy. Yes, Antiochus. I couldn't get his name. He desecrated the altar, I believe, by offering pigs there. When Titus came into the city, it's recorded that he took his ensigns, his Roman military ensigns, and set them up where the temple had been, because, of course, the temple was destroyed by the time he got in there. But anyway, set it all up, and they had their idols standing in the place where the altar would have been. Now, the thing that puzzles me just a little bit about those two interpretations is that Jesus said specifically that when you see this happen, you are supposed to flee to the mountains. And if this was referring to General Titus, then it would have been too late to flee. So this had to happen. This abomination of desolation had to happen in this view of it being past. It would have had to happen before the destruction of Jerusalem while there was still time to get out, because it was a sign to get out of the city. So I really don't think it was Titus. That's my view. When did it happen? I don't know. There was definitely a lot of wickedness going on in the city of Jerusalem, and it could really refer to a whole bunch of things. If you really want it to be fulfilled before the destruction of Jerusalem, there would be things that could lead you to believe that. Jesus mentions that you're to flee. You're not supposed to try to take anything with you. Just get out. And he also says that it's going to be unhandy if you have children, and it's going to be very unhandy if it's in winter and if it's on the Sabbath day. And then he talks about great tribulation. And here's another phrase that trips up my mind when I'm trying to imagine that all of this is past. I'm just a little bit, I'm a little soft on this, in case you haven't picked up on that. But it says, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor shall ever shall be. That phrase, no, nor ever shall be, is interesting because the Jews have certainly faced persecution at least as bad as the time the generals destroyed the city. Since then, you think of Hitler, for instance. But anyway, if your view is that it's all past, then you could say that that definitely was fulfilled when Titus and his soldiers finally did breach the city, and the slaughter that they carried out was terrible. And it really was. I'm not denying that at all. Now, I am not schooled enough in these views of all of this being past to be able to defend very well the next couple of verses. Verses 23 through 31, people will say, the people I've been reading and studying the articles and whatnot, they say that this is past as well, that they have no problem describing the sun being darkened and the moon giving not her light and the stars falling from heaven and all of that. There's no question in their mind that this can be easily answered and made to say that this is referring to the fall of monarchs and nations. And you can turn to passages like Isaiah 13, where there's similar language describing the fall of a nation. Jeremiah chapter 4 is also similar in that, where it talks about the darkening of the sky and the heavens. And it's in reference to the judgment of nations. And they say that this fits. God is judging nations here, and so the stars falling and all of that, they're easy to understand. You don't have to expect stars to start falling out of the sky. And for whatever it's worth, I'll throw in here too that Josephus records over the time a strange comet that had been shining around in the sky, and also a strange sword-shaped star that he had no explanation for. That's getting out there into mysticism a little bit far for me. I'm not sure what to do with all of that, but you can take it and do with it what you want. So, is it past or isn't it? Well, there's also the people that would take this view. They would say that even verses 30, 31, that has been fulfilled. The sign of the Son of Man in heaven, they make a big deal out of the fact that it says, the sign of the Son of Man. It isn't actually the Son of Man, but I'm not sure what they do with the last part of the verse where it talks about the Son of Man coming in the clouds. But they would say that just simply means that Jesus is ruling and his words are being fulfilled. When you get to verse 34, you come across another troublesome verse because Jesus uses the word this generation. And I have no idea what it would say in another language, but in English it says this. And we all know that when we say this, I talk about something close to me. I would talk about this congregation. I wouldn't talk about this congregation out at Smithdale. That's that congregation, right? Okay, so we get this whole grammatical thing going on here. And so when Jesus says, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled, the people that take the view that I've just presented to you very broadly, they will say, see, it has to be past because that generation is gone. It has to have happened. Otherwise, Jesus is wrong. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, I believe then, if I understand this view correctly, that the next part of the chapter, verses 36 and on, are describing the end of the world in which Jesus judges, and nobody knows when that's going to happen. It's just going to happen one day, and everybody will know that it has happened, and it talks about how some people will be taken away and others people will be left, and so on and so forth. And so that's all future. Well, the other major view that I'm going to discuss with you just a little bit is that this is all future. None of this has happened to the full yet. Yes, some of the things may seem to have happened at the fall of Jerusalem, But they are merely a shadow of what is to happen in the final judgment and tribulation of the world. Now, full disclosure, this is what I grew up with. And it is really, really hard for me to approach something like this without, in other words, for me to just say that everything I was ever taught about this is wrong is really difficult to do. Just like it's difficult for you to do. And so when you look at these passages and you say these are signs that are building up to the end of the age, they are often referred to as birth pains, that simply means that as time goes on, these signs will increase in occurrence and frequency and in intensity. And so when you read something like people coming around saying, I am Christ, you say, well, that has happened. Yes, it has. But the idea is that in the future, as the Lord continues to tarry in sending Jesus back to this earth, that these things will get worse and worse, and they will happen more often. And then when you get to a verse like verse 13 and in verse 22, you get this idea that except the days, this whole time period, unless that's been shortened, all of us will stand a really good chance to be lost, because it says in verse 22, if the days aren't shortened, that no flesh will be saved, because the oppression and the disturbance and the deception will be so bad that the only way to stop it is for Jesus to step in and say, enough is enough. Now, if you have not been schooled that way, that all sounds really strange and almost probably sounds heretical. But I would ask you to simply allow for the possibility that that might be true. When we get to passages like verse 15, then, when it talks about the abomination of desolation, yes, that did happen. We have the pig being offered. We have the Roman generals and so on putting up their idols there. But there's also this idea that this is yet future, that there will be another time that someone will desecrate a temple. Now, that causes a problem because there is no temple. Well, the idea is that the temple will be rebuilt. Is that possible? Well, anything's possible. And there are people trying to rebuild the temple. There's a fight over real estate over there about where it should be, but there is this concept that the temple should be rebuilt. And again, I know all of you well enough to know that what I'm saying, you're just probably not taking very seriously, and that's okay. You don't have to take it seriously. You see, one of the reasons that a view like this becomes a little bit problematic is because when we come to a verse like verse 36, but of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only, we say, see, if we have to wait for a temple to be built, then suddenly Jesus can't come back yet. Is that true? Well, I really probably should have put the pulpit at the back of the church so I could get out of here faster. But just think with me a little bit. Did people know that there was a flood coming? Yeah, they knew. They knew there was a flood coming. I'm pretty sure Noah didn't build that ark all by himself with his three boys. They probably had help. He probably told them why he was building the ark. The animals went into the ark. People probably saw that happening. But they didn't know exactly when the rain would start. But they definitely saw things happening before the rain started. And so if we take Jesus' comparisons to the days of Noah, is it just crazy to say that there will be certain things that we should look for, that there will be things that might have to happen before Jesus returns? Is it a possibility? And does that make lazy Christians? Do we need to scare people with the imminent return of Jesus Christ? You know what? It doesn't work anyway. I said way more than I intended to. Thank you for listening. So when you get to these things like verse 29 and some of those things, it doesn't trouble me very much to say, yes, there are things we need to be looking for, and no, we still do not know exactly when it will happen. I think the two are very compatible. It's my view. Also, you will notice that the concept of people being called out of the earth, the big word that's used for that is the rapture, where people will be, people who believe, have accepted Christ by faith, will escape the wrath of God. And there's hints of that in verse 31. And there's also hints of it in verses 40 and 41, where it talks about one being taken, the other left. Where are they taken and where are they left? I just asked the question. Okay, well, I realize that by saying only as much as I have and not any more, that there are probably huge questions that you would like me to answer. And I welcome that. Perfectly okay with that. The big question that you probably really want to know is, what do I really believe? Well, I've been kind of giving you hints of that all along. I see a lot of credit to the study and the belief of the divided view, that part of this has been completely fulfilled and part of it is yet to come. It's a lot of credit there. But I really struggle with making verses 29 through 35 past. And maybe that's not what everybody does. Maybe that's just what this author that I was studying says. When you get to verses 29 through 35, it seems really hard to make that past. However, I will grant that prophetic language, and this is prophetic, when Jesus spoke it, it was futuristic. It's pretty hard to grasp. I understand that. There was prophecies about Jesus that if you would look at them without the help of the New Testament, you would say that it's referring to something else. It's not referring to anything future. And yet Matthew makes it plain that many of those things were yet to be fulfilled. And so I don't know if I just undid my argument about that or if I made it stronger. I'm not sure. It's also very explicit about the end of the world being after the gospel is preached. Does that mean the end of Jerusalem? Or does that mean, well, I shouldn't say the end of the world. It says the end. And the question that I have is, what end? Is it the end of Jerusalem? Is it the end of the world? Is it the end of, what is it? What's the end? There's also a question in my mind in verse 22 about what those days are. See, if those days, if that passage right there, these are just questions that I have that maybe I need more light on. But if those days in verse 22 are referring to the time that the Romans entered Jerusalem, who are the elect? You're left with two possibilities. The elect are either the Jews or the elect are the Christians. And history tells us that the Christians weren't in Jerusalem at this time. So now you've just said that the Jews are God's elect. And that opens up another huge discussion. So I'm not sure what to do with verse 22 if it's all past. The future view, I admit, has problems. It's what I've been taught, and it has caused me a lot of anxiety as far as where does all this work and how is it supposed to be, and can we really know if it's all going to work out the way we say it's going to? By its very nature, if we would accept that this is future, we have suddenly put this into a realm that none of us can understand. And so it's really a strange thing to say that this is future and yet be adamant that this has to be the way it is. Because we're saying two different things. We're not capable in our human minds to be able to know what the future will be. I believe, though, that there is enough in this passage that would lend itself to a future idea that I would say with Jesus that we need to watch. Verse 42, watch, therefore. We need to be watching. We need to be aware of what's happening around us. We need to be aware of what has already happened. We need to be resting in the fact that Jesus Christ will take care of his church no matter what. It doesn't matter what. And that's what I really want us to get a hold of, is that Jesus knows what he meant. We're taking some guesses at it. Some of it seems like it might have already happened. Some of it seems like it probably hasn't. And for us to force one interpretation or the other feels scary to me. Because if we force it all to be past, we may miss some things that we should be watching for in the future. If we force it all into the future, we may miss what Jesus has tried to show us in the past. So, five things, I want to close with. Some very practical things after all of that. What can we learn? What good will it be tomorrow when you study or when you live your life? Well, number one, no matter what view you take, whether it's past, future, divided, whatever, Jesus says several times that it is possible for us to be deceived. And I want us to know that, and I want me to know that, that when we begin to look around for answers, when we begin to listen to people who come up with a new Christ, other than the biblical Christ, be very, very careful. In fact, run away from them. And that's another message that's kind of brewing in my mind about who Jesus really is and what does he mean for us today. Maybe Ben should take that one. But there's a lot of people out there that are telling us about Jesus, and it's not Jesus. It's somebody else. It's somebody they've created in their own minds. It's not Jesus Christ. And I'll just throw it out here right now. Be very, very careful of all the modern devotional books. They are, by and large, not fit. I shouldn't say they're not fit to read. That didn't sound right. They are deceptive. That's what they are. Did you say shallow? Yeah, well, that too. Anyway, number two. Something that I believe we can take away from this chapter is that there is a real possibility for us as North American Christians that we will face physical persecution. I do not know why God has allowed us the last 200 years or whatever it is to be relatively at rest. We could go around and talk about how we need to be more bold and all that. That's possible, but it's not normal for... If you study the history of Christianity, what we've experienced is not necessarily normal. On the other hand, have we done very well at passing the test of prosperity? I don't know. Why would Satan persecute us if he knows that half of us here are not doing so well? He's got his job done, right? But I'm not here to scare anybody. Thinking about persecution is a scary thing. And I do not believe that future persecution will be physical in the sense that you'll probably have to face getting your head cut off or being burned at the stake. Civilization is a little too sophisticated for that. At least we think so. But there may be persecution that would be really easy to rationalize. That all you would have to do is just fudge on this principle just a little bit. All you'd have to do is fudge on the whole marriage issue just a little bit to fit with the agenda. And if we don't do it, then all of a sudden we're facing fines, we're facing possibility of getting our church shut down. To me, that's what, I'm not a prophet, and I'm not even trying to claim that I know what the future is, but that could very likely be the type of persecution we will face. The question is, what is Jesus worth? Is what you've been taught about Jesus going to keep us, is that going to keep me where I need to be in those kind of tests? Do I really believe what the Bible says? Which takes me to number three. It's practical things to learn here. Jesus' words can be relied on. We learn that from verse 35. Jesus says, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away." Those are pretty strong words. Jesus' words will stand after everything else is gone. And that's why we need to fill ourselves up with him and his words. Number four, I already mentioned this, but just mention it again. The coming of the Son of Man, Jesus says, is going to be as the days of Noah. And he talks about how they were living very normal lives. They ate and drank, they got married, had families. And it was just this crazy guy over here building a big old boat. And life was pretty normal. Life is pretty normal. And I expect that it will be very normal all the way up to the end, whatever normal happens to be. But let's not lose the urgency of watching in the normalcy of life. It's very easy to do. I don't often think about the end coming. I'm just worried about getting through the next day or the week. Or maybe year, we might plan out that far. But we don't often think that this day actually could be the end. It could be. So let's look out for boat builders. Maybe we should be boat builders. Let's watch out for animals getting into the ark. Let's listen to preachers of righteousness like Noah. Because normal life one day will not be normal. And I want to just end with a couple questions. In verses 46, I'm sorry, verses 45 through 51, 45 through 51, there's a little parable here Jesus gives about faithful and wise servants versus evil servants. And the question rings in my mind, which kind of servant am I? Am I just an evil servant who says, well, God's not coming back. He's not sending Jesus back yet. I did kind of say that, though, didn't I? But anyway, the temptation in that situation is to begin to live as if it doesn't matter. But it does matter. Because how we live our lives is going to really, at the end of life, at the end of time for us, decide where we are. We will either be in verse 47, with Jesus ruling over all his goods, and why he would do that for us, I have no idea. But we will either be that, we will either be there, or we will be there with the hypocrites in verse 51, where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. And remember that Jesus said his words will not pass away. These are real words. Not many of us wonder whether these things have been fulfilled or whether they will be fulfilled. We know that it means what it says. And we need to be very careful about that. I don't know if I like to end on that kind of warning, but maybe I just will this morning, that it's serious business. It is life or death, eternal life or eternal death. And we need to be watching and ready for Jesus to return.